Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 54. I'm recording it on Thursday, December 4th, 2008. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is Does Robert Shiller Pull His Punches? Robert Shiller, of course, is the author of the book Irrational Exuberance. He's known as a bear. I don't agree that he's a bear, but that's what he's known for. He's known for presenting the negative case for stocks when they are valued at insane price levels. His book was a bestseller. He's the godfather of rational investing. Rational investing is the approach to investing that I describe in all my podcasts. And that approach to investing, it has its roots in the work of, it's really a combination of the work of Robert Shiller, John Bogle, and Warren Buffett. And there are many others whose ideas I've linked in. But those, I would say, are the three. Especially Shiller and Bogle are the two godfathers, but Buffett plays a role too in the concept of looking at value. Buffett is a value investor, and rational investing is a value an approach that looks for value propositions, long-term value propositions, and all three of those are long-term investors as well. That's another common theme. Many people think that Shiller, Buffett, and Bogle are different. They're coming from different camps. I see the differences, of course, but I see greater similarities. I see a lot of similarities in those three. But not many people would think that Shiller is one to pull his punches. He's known for taking a hard line on stocks, warning people that stocks were insanely overvalued dating all the way back to the mid-1990s. He gave his Irrational Exuberance testimony back in 1996. But and of course I agree with all that, and I'm going to in the beginning of the podcast go through all of Shiller's wonderful accomplishments, not all of them, but I'm going to summarize some of the highlights. But I had the idea for writing an article arguing the case made in this podcast that Shiller pulls his punches back when I wrote an article for the Valuation Informed Indexing section of the site. I think it was the article entitled The Efficient Market Theory is a Big Bunch of Hooey. And I was writing that, and I'm obviously mocking the efficient market theory in that article. And when I was doing that, I pulled out a chapter. Shiller has a chapter on the efficient market theory in his book, and I pulled that out. And there was some, you know, the chapter makes very clear that the efficient market theory does not stand up to scrutiny. Shiller presents a devastating case, but there are some lines in there that sort of threw me for a bit of a loop. I'll read them, and this is what first put the idea of I was originally thinking of writing an article. It's now turned into a podcast on this theme. Shiller says, stock prices by this theory, he's talking about the efficient market theory, approximately describe random walks through time. The price changes are unpredictable since they occur only in response to genuinely new information, which by the very fact that it is new is unpredictable. The efficient market theory and the random walk hypothesis have been subjected to many tests using data on stock markets in studies published in scholarly journals of finance and economics. Although the theory has been statistically rejected many times in these publications, By some interpretations, it may nevertheless be described as approximately true. The literature on the evidence for this theory is well developed and includes work of the highest quality. Therefore, whether or not we ultimately agree with it, we must at least take the efficient markets theory seriously. Now, you could look at that statement and just say, well, he's being very fair, and Shiller is an extraordinarily fair-minded person in my assessment. Over and over again, he states his views. He's fair to the other side. He's balanced. People describe some of his views as being extreme, but I don't think they're extreme at all. If anything, I almost think he tilts in the other direction. Given what he understands about the markets, I think he tilts in the direction of undercutting his points, not presenting them as strongly as he might. And that's sort of the theme of this podcast, that people think of Shiller as being anti-stock and being harsh and being extreme. The reality is quite to the contrary. Shiller looks at things that other people don't look at, and so his conclusions are different than theirs. And on the spectrum of public opinion, his views are anti-stock compared to what most were saying during the times of insane price levels. But when you look at things from Shiller's perspective, that's the perspective of a rational investor, somebody who understands that valuations affect long-term returns. When you look at it from that perspective, his views are not extreme. His views are right down the middle of the road, given his beliefs, given the perspective from which he is coming at things. And that's the point of this podcast, to try to dispel this idea that Shiller is somehow extremist or harsh or, you know, mean. You know, they always call me mean when I go to discussion boards and talk about what the historical data says about the effect of valuations on long-term returns. They say, Rob, you're so mean. Why are you so mean? And I don't think I am mean, and I don't think Shiller's mean. And so I'm trying to make that case here. But when I read these words about the efficient market theory, as I say, they threw me a little bit, because here's what goes on. When you're trying to make the case for rational investing, when you're trying to, passive investing is the dominant model of today. You just hear it everywhere. You know, all your friends have been, you know, saturated with it. The media is saturated with it. The people you're going to meet on discussion boards are saturated with it. And so to take the other side takes more than a little bit of courage. It really does. And I've worked up my courage over time. I didn't start with it. I was very tentative and compromising and soft when I first started talking about valuations. And it's only over time when I've discovered that the case on the other side is not nearly as strong as I once thought it was, and that the evidence for the side that valuations matter is overwhelming, that I've become stronger and stronger because I've come to believe that this is really important, that people hear this message. But when I was writing that article, The Efficient Market Theory is a Big Bunch of Hooey, I read these words from Shiller, and when you obviously I respect Shiller, and when I read these words, I said, am I wrong? You know, am I coming on too strong? That's what happens, because we don't have many people, those of us arguing for rational investing, we don't have many people taking our side, and we need to have something to confirm that we're right. And even Shiller here, as I say, I think he's doing it in fairness. None of the statements he makes are false. They're all, you know, they're right. But it's a funny phenomenon that the passive investing enthusiast, I don't feel do this at all. They don't make an effort to present the other side fairly. And the rational investors go so far with this that it almost makes other rational investors doubt what they believe. You know, he says, it's a curious sentence. He says, although this theory has been statistically rejected many times, you know, that sure sounds like the efficient market theory doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Then he says, by some interpretations, it may nevertheless be described as approximately true. That's such a strange sentence. If it's true, how is it that it's been rejected? Now, maybe the key is where he says by some interpretations. One thing I've discovered is people who support the efficient market theory change the definition of what it means, some of them, 5 times in one discussion. They just change what they believe so that once you disprove, you know, their first description of the theory, they switch to version B. And then when you disprove version B, they switch to version C. Maybe that's what he means. And there clearly is something to the efficient market theory. If I believe the market truly is efficient at the end of 30 years. So the market is in the process of becoming efficient. It is not instantly efficient. That's the claim. The claim is that the market is efficient instantly, and it is only efficient after a long passage of time. But so, you know, it's not unfair to say that it's approximately true under some interpretations. But that is certainly not a harsh criticism of the theory, and the reality is this theory has caused great human misery. It has caused all investing advice, well, not all, but 90% of the investing advice we have heard for the past 20 or 30 years to be very seriously wrong, very seriously misleading. So this is a theory that has probably caused more human misery than any theory in the personal finance field in history. So, you know, looking at it from that perspective, I think a title like the one I had on my article, "The Efficient Market Theory is a Big Bunch of Hooey," is appropriate. So I think it's interesting that Shiller, while always being correct and always being honest and always being brave in his writing, shades it a different way. You know, he almost goes out of his way to be fair and to shade it a different way, somewhat to his credit. You know, that is a good tendency. The only question is whether he goes too far, and I don't really think he does. I don't think he does go too far. I think he gets it right. I think he was right to present things the way he did in this book that was published in the year 2000. I think that over time, though, those who follow in Shiller's footsteps need to come on stronger. So the answer to the question I pose in the title of this podcast, does Shiller pull his punches? My answer is generally not. Shiller tells it the way it is. But Shiller was doing something radical when he published this book. And, you know, 8-9 years have passed since he published it. And today, I think we need to start going beyond Shiller. I think we should always refer to this wonderful book. You know, it's the new Bible of stock investing. And we'll get, it's rich in insights, and we'll be mining those insights for many decades to come. But we're all going to be walking in the shadow of Shiller for you know, a long, long time. But as we move forward, we have to stop thinking that Shiller took things as far as they could be taken. We have to realize that he wrote his book in an environment in which, oh, when he published this book, the idea of looking at valuations was just hated with a burning intensity. And he had the courage to stand up in the crowd and tell it the way it is. And, you know, so for that, he should always be our champion. But it's not enough just to repeat what Shiller said when he published this book in March of 2000. People following the rational investing course today need to actually be a little stronger, because now the case is so much stronger. After the stock crash, the evidence that passive investing does not work is you know, so widespread, so obvious, that I think it would be wrong at this point to phrase things the way Shiller did back in March of 2000. Today, I think the appropriate thing is to say the efficient market theory is a big bunch of hooey. Still, to be fair, we should still be fair. We should still be fair-minded. And his statement, you know, he says, the literature on the evidence for this theory is well-developed and includes work of the highest quality. Therefore, whether or not we ultimately agree with it, we must at least take the efficient market theory seriously. Well, yes and no. We should take it seriously because the efficient market theory added to our understanding of how stock works in a very dramatic, important way. And we should always, of course, show respect for the people who have taught it, the John Bogles of the world and the Eugene Famas of the world and the Burton Malkals of the world. We should always show respect for those people. But I do think we have to show, disrespect, frankly, for the idea. Because the idea had great value, but the idea has turned out to be wrong, and we need to have this idea pass from the scene. This idea is now blocking progress, and we need to move forward. And so the way that human beings make clear that an idea needs to be left behind is, you know, at some point they argue the case. And that's what Schiller did. He argued the case. It's now been 8-9 years, and no one has been able to refute what Schiller said. The evidence that he is right just goes stronger and stronger and stronger with every day. Given that, there comes a time when you stop arguing as if the other side had merit, and you start in a gentle, sort of fun-loving way, ridiculing the idea. And I think we've reached that stage. That's my opinion. So when I put up an article entitled "The Efficient Market Theory is a Big Bunch of Hooey," I don't mean to mock any person. And I think I included a message to that effect in that article. I said, please don't take this as any criticism of the people. But please do take it as a gentle mocking of the idea. Because the idea, frankly, is silly. It's a half-truth. The efficient market theory is a half-truth. It has truth in it, important truth, and we certainly need to mine the truth in it and build on that, and I certainly try to do that. But the parts that are wrong, the idea, you see, if you believe in the efficient market theory, as it has been described by its proponents, you believe the timing does not work. Timing the market does not work. You should stay at the same stock allocation at all times. If you believe the efficient market theory is nonsense, at least as it has been described, then you believe you must time the market. It's required. So whether the theory is true as described or not is a very important question. And we need to get that question settled. We can't have this situation where we have someone like Schiller and many others, you know, in his school of thought, who have presented rock-solid evidence that the efficient market theory is wrong, and yet still have millions of middle-class Americans being advised not to time the market, even in a long-term sense, not even to engage in long-term timing, which is necessary for buy and hold to work. So that's sort of the point of this whole podcast. It's this tension between, on the one hand, you want to be fair, which Schiller very much is. And on the other hand, you want to advance the ball. We want to advance our understanding of how stock investing works. And for that to happen, we're going to have to start being a little more blunt, a little more tough in our wording. Although I personally believe Schiller handled it just right in his book. He is tough, and he's just tough enough, but he's also very, very, very fair. And I think that was the right thing to do in that climate. But I think time has passed. And it's time now to start moving the ball a little farther along. Now, before I get into the points about, you know, how Schiller pulls his punches, in my view, I first wanted to make some comments about the importance of his accomplishment. Irrational Exuberance, in my assessment, is the best book on investing ever published. And there are many fine books on investing. I think Stocks for the Long Run is a wonderful book. Bogle's Common Sense on Mutual Funds is a wonderful book. Malkiel's Random Walk Down Wall Street is a wonderful book. The collection of Buffett's Letters to His Shareholders, his annual letter to shareholders is a wonderful book. David Dreeman's Contrarian Investing is a wonderful book. There are, of course, many of them. But of all of them, I would rank Irrational Exuberance first. And frankly, the reason I would rank it first, there are many, many wonderful qualities to the book. But I think the number one reason I would rank it so high is the courage behind it. And that's why my title is almost, you know, it's deliberately provocative. Schiller is a man of courage. I saw there was a thread at bogleheads.org a couple weeks ago, and the guy made a great point. The guy said he saw Schiller on television once, and he said, you know, they were asking his opinions, and Schiller clearly wanted to warn people about stocks, and then you could see the agony on his face, and he sort of pulled back a little bit and softened his comments. And the guy said, this is terrible. He said, it's like living under a regime where we're not allowed to speak freely on investing. And I so much agree. That's the biggest problem in the investing world, that we don't have free speech to talk about investing, the realities of how stock investing works. But someone came on and said, maybe Schiller's just a wuss. And, you know, there's no truth to that. This book irrational exuberance is written in blood. I don't know Schiller's history. I know some of it, but, you know, only you know, things that you read. I haven't followed him closely enough to know his whole history, but I know that he's been doing research showing valuations affect long-term returns dating back to 1981. So he wrote this book after studying this for a minimum of 20 years, devoting his whole life to it. And it is impossible for me to believe that Schiller has not been subject to vicious criticism over that 20 years, now almost 30 years. Because I know, you know, what sort of tactics are used to stomp out frank discussion of the investing realities during a wild bull market. So this book is written in blood. This is the real thing. It's an act of courage, and it's an act of intellect. It's a brilliant book, and it's a beautifully written book. Not in the sense that it's written in a poetic style, but in that I have read the book two times full and one time skimming it. And I did a podcast on one section of the book a few weeks ago, and I got to some sentences there that I had never even really noted before. They hadn't hit me. And that's the mark of a really well-done book, that it's so deep that you can read it numerous times and always find new things in it. So there are many wonderful qualities to the book, but the quality that puts it above any other book ever published on investing is how hard it must have been to write it, to speak truth to power. That's really what Schiller does. And I couldn't possibly admire him more for that. So it's a wonderful book. Now, and it's a brave book. So that, of course, argues that Schiller does not pull his punches. Some other points that I'll say on behalf of the Schiller side of this case. Schiller describes stock investing as a Ponzi scheme at times of high valuations. And this made me laugh when I read it. And I have a personal story about it. Maybe it won't impress you as much as it did me, but there's a fellow named Sershnitz at the Morningstar boards. He used to post at the Vanguard Diehards board and at the Income and Dividend Investing board. And there's really no one other than John Walter Russell, who I have met on discussion boards, who I admire as much as Sershnitz. And the reason is, Sershnitz does not agree with my views on investing. But he has defended me, you know, my right to speak and my right to write, you know, to give my sincere views on discussion boards. And he has defended me in very, very strong terms. And of course, if someone who agrees with you does that, you're happy about it and you admire the person for sticking their neck out. But Sershnitz was defending someone who he didn't agree with. And that's class. And I've never forgotten it. I don't think there's anyone I've ever posted with that I've as much enjoyed. And we got into some discussions where we were giving the different points of view. And I could really respect this guy because I knew he's posting sincere. But in one of those discussions, and this was about 2 years ago, it was around Christmas time 2 years ago. And Sershnitz was, I don't recall the whole thread, but I recall at one point I pulled out this phrase, which I had picked up from Schiller, where I said, at times when prices are at insanely high levels, as they were 2 years ago, investing in stocks is like investing in a Ponzi scheme. And Sershnitz was just totally taken aback. I mean, you could almost see his jaw drop open. And I think he was tempted, you know, he was tempted to almost go the goon route. He was tempted to say, Rob, you're nuts. You know, where do you come up with this stuff? Because it was blowing his mind. He had never heard stocks described as a Ponzi scheme. And he didn't do it. He didn't do it. He just, you know, he came back with a classy response and he ultimately said, Rob, you have your opinion and I have mine. You know, and he clearly didn't agree, but you know, he stayed on the right side of the line. But I got, you know, what I often do is I'll read a book like Schiller's and I'll go back and read it for just this purpose. Am I being tough enough? I'll ask myself, you know, am I being tough enough in my posting? Because the big danger, the whole reason why stocks get so insanely overpriced is that people want to be liked. And so people hold back. They don't give their true opinions. And when lots of people do that, stocks go to insane price levels. It's like driving a car without brakes. That's really what happens in a bull market. You're driving along, everything's fine, and then prices start to go too high. And there's a choice we all make. And if we make the right choice, you know, stocks go to a 21 PE10 level. If we are healthy, if the community of investors is healthy, people jump in and they say, whoa, slow down, this is dangerous. And then the PE10 level drops to 17 or 18. But if for some reason we don't do that, we don't apply the brakes, well, then you can go from 21 to anything. You can go to 25, you can go to 30, you can go to 33 like we did in 1929, you can go to 44 like we did in 1999. In other words, it's when the community loses, the people who criticize overvaluation, that we get into the sort of situations where we cause depressions. The overvaluation goes to such an extreme level that returning to fair value, as we must ultimately, or the market would collapse, returning to fair value causes either a deep recession or a depression because things get so out of control. And of course, the long-term goal should be, how do we stop that? And Shiller talked about it in an article I read. I think it was published at the Atlantic Magazine website. Just the other day I read this. And he said, people determine how to invest by what other people tell them. And he says, that's quite reasonable. That's quite rational. And I agree. It's the way we learn about everything in life. When you're trying to decide, you know, what's a good restaurant to go to, you ask your friends. When you're trying to decide, you know, what neighborhood to live in, you ask friends, you ask people who live there. That's how we learn. And with stocks, it sometimes works. But when we go to insane price levels, of course, it doesn't work at all. And the problem is that the community has broken down. The community has broken down. And what's happened is those who have doubts, those who are uneasy with insane price levels, self-censor. They get to a point where they stop saying what they believe. And at that point, you're riding a car without brakes. And that's what I think of as, that's the contribution of passive investing. That's what passive investing did to us. Passive investing is rooted in a lot of good stuff. But it became dogmatic. And when it became dogmatic, and when it started to claim science, it started to claim it was a science, that you don't have to change your stock allocation when prices go to insane levels. At that point, passive investing led to self-censorship. So it's, you know, what I will do is I sometimes test myself to see, am I engaging in self-censorship? Because I certainly have done so at many times in my life on the investing question. And so I'll turn to somebody like Shiller and see if I can get support, or whether I should go harder. And when I saw that Shiller compared the stock market at a time of overvaluation to a Ponzi scheme, you know, that gave me a lot of comfort that, hey, maybe I'm not being tough enough. Here's a sentence from Shiller, page 67 of my copy. The extension from Ponzi schemes to naturally occurring speculative bubbles appears so natural that one must conclude, if there is to be debate about speculative bubbles, that the burden of proof is on skeptics to provide evidence as to why Ponzi-like speculative bubbles cannot occur. In other words, he's saying the burden of proof should be the other way. He says, many of the major finance textbooks today, which promote a view of financial markets as working rationally and efficiently, do not provide arguments as to why feedback loops supporting speculative bubbles cannot occur. In fact, they do not even mention bubbles or Ponzi schemes. And he's criticizing that. That's wonderful. That's wonderful stuff. So that's obviously a case for the argument that Shiller does not pull his punches. Shiller's a straight talker. Shiller's a brave writer and a brave thinker. And another one like that is this line that I discovered a few weeks ago when I did an earlier podcast, and I had skipped over this the first three times I read the book. He says on page 203 of my copy, it is a serious mistake for public figures to acquiesce in the stock market valuations we have seen recently. to remain silent about the implications of such high valuations, and to leave all commentary to the market analyst. Wow, what Shiller is saying there is that, you know, he's saying politicians should be addressing overvaluation. Can you imagine a day? This is what came to my mind when I was reading this. Can you imagine a day when the President of the United States, you know, announces he's giving a speech and he stands before us and he says, it has come to my attention that the PE10 level today reached 21. We are now in the red alert danger zone, and I don't want this country to go through, you know, the horrible recession, the passive investing recession that began in 2008 because of the insane price levels that we went to in the 1990s. And I ask everyone who can to do all they can to bring stock prices lower. Can you imagine that? I don't think most people can imagine it, but it's exactly what we need. We need public pressure to pull stock prices down when they go to insanely high levels. We all suffer from wild bull markets because wild bull markets always lead to wild bear markets. The more wild on the upside, the more wild on the downside. And these downside bear markets cause people to lose their jobs. They cause businesses to fail. They cause people to lose their houses. And you know, people in the public policy realm should be addressing this. But they never have historically. But Shiller's saying they should. And you know, you could write a whole book on that sentence, exploring the implications of that sentence. So that's the mark of a courageous writer, not of a writer who pulls his punches. Now, there's a strong case that Shiller does not pull his punches. Of course, another one is his prediction. Shiller made a famous prediction in 1996 where he said, people who own stocks today are likely going to regret having done so within the next 10 years. Again, could you make a braver comment? And there are many people who have criticized Shiller. They said he was wrong. And in a very hyper-technical sense, you could say that he was wrong, because if you look at stock returns from 1996 through 2006, they were not too bad. You know, we had huge returns in 97, 98, 99, and then stocks became dead money from the year 2000 through, you know, the end of 2007. And then we had a huge price crash in the past year. So if you went just from 96 to 2006, the stock return was not too bad. And so it's not true that people would have regretted being in stock. So in a hyper-technical sense, he was wrong. But of course, the turning point was January of 2000. So he was, you know, within 4 years of the time he made that statement, stocks began performing poorly. And now, after we've experienced the crash in 2008, the statement is true that from 1996, you would have been better going with much safer asset classes where you could have earned a higher return at much less risk. So today, the statement is true. We're a little outside that 10-year window. And if Shiller had just given the proper caveats, his statement would have been completely true. When you use the historical data to predict future stock returns, you're not able to predict them with precision. So you may think something's going to take place in 10 years, and it may actually take 12 years. So any fair-minded person would say today that Shiller was far more right than he was wrong. And that was a brave prediction. And it's a prediction that has stood the test of time. Shiller has prevailed over his critics. Again, that's the mark of somebody who does not pull his punches. Shiller also called the housing bubble. He not only called the stock bubble, he called the housing bubble. Shiller is he's much deeper and much more sophisticated in his thinking than he's generally given credit for. My pet peeve in the investing area is when people describe Shiller and they will often say, "Oh, he called the bubble, you know, of 2000," because this book happened to come out in March of 2000 and stock prices crashed around that time. That's a trivial way of referring to his accomplishments. Schiller's book just happened to come out at that time. He doesn't believe in short-term timing, so he never tried to call the bubble. He was predicting stocks would go down back in 19... The way I should say it is, he was saying that stocks offered a poor long-term value proposition back in 1996. So the fact that the book came out in March 2000 is trivial. And they turn his accomplishment, which is a major one, Schiller has changed the history of investing. They turn that into like a parlor trick. But the reality of Schiller is that he's not somebody who calls times the market or calls the popping of a bubble. That's not what he does. What he really does is offer the first fully sensible approach to stock investing. I really think that's what he's done. That's why I say his book is so valuable, because all of these other people I mentioned have offered great books, but they all miss the valuation / human emotion side of the question. They discuss it, in little ways, but it's not a major theme of any of those books I mentioned. But in Schiller's book, it's core. And so he's done something. If human emotion is half of the stock investing picture, and I think it is, Schiller has opened up half of what there is to know about stocks to our view. So again, that's not pulling punches. That's being a champion fighter, champion battler. And, as I mentioned earlier, he has research dating all the way back to 1981. There was recently a paper that came out by Brad DeLong, an economist, saying that Schiller's findings from 1981, which some doubted, of course, these are the passive investing enthusiasts, they doubted. They described it as possibly being, quote, junk science, because Schiller was only looking backward. And we had not seen how his findings would appear when tested out of sample. Well, now they've been tested out of sample with this price crash. And Schiller's work has stood the test of time. Schiller's work has prevailed. The work of the passive investing enthusiast has failed. It's failed in its first test in the real world. So again, for Schiller to take on all the people he took on was an act of tremendous courage. So why is there any question whatsoever as to whether Schiller pulls his punches? Well, I'll mention some ways in which he did. The first is his handling of the efficient market theory that I already went over in the beginning minutes of the podcast. Schiller bends over backwards to be fair. Now, most did not describe him that way. Most would say, oh, he's a harsh critic of the efficient market theory. Because, of course, at the time he wrote the book, 90% of the investing experts believed in the efficient market theory. But he's pulled his punches in this sense. I talk about this all the time. Rob Arnott recently spoke at a conference of academics that do investing research. And he asked for a raise, he asked for a show of hands. How many of the 200 academics in attendance believe in the efficient market theory? And not one raised his or her hand. And then he asked how many are going to use the efficient market theory in the research they do when they get back to their office on Monday morning. And nearly all of them raised their hand. That's what Schiller and all rational investors are up against. We live in a world where the research has shown for 2 to 3 decades now that the efficient market theory has failed. And yet, it remains the dominant theory of investing today. That's the world we live in. And so, Schiller was right to bend over backwards in fairness, but ultimately, in an ultimate sense, we need to be much stronger in our criticism of the efficient market theory, because the soft approach that Schiller takes hasn't done the job. He got the ideas out in the public marketplace, and hurrah for Schiller, but so far we have not convinced enough people that the efficient market theory has failed. In order to get discussions of rational investing strategies permitted, you know, they're banned in a direct way on a lot of discussion boards, but they're banned in less formal ways in lots of other places. I remember that woman who sent me an email some months back saying, you know, thanks for your site. I was having doubts about stocks, and I found when I tried to talk this over with my friends that I couldn't talk about it. It wasn't permitted, that people just get too upset. And of course, the problem is that we all know on some level, we all have common sense, and we all know on some level that passive investing cannot possibly work. And Shiller went a long ways to giving us the intellectual ammunition we need to make that case and to make it publicly. But we need to make it stronger than he made it in his book. That's really the point of this podcast. Another way in which Shiller pulled his punches a bit, there's a little suggestion of this in his book, but not much. He doesn't talk about the hostility directed at him by his colleagues as a result of his research. I do recall, I don't know the page of the book, but I do recall there being some discussion of that. It was only a sentence or two, you know, that he got some letters or something. I have to believe that Shiller has been subject to fierce opposition over the years because he is upsetting every apple cart there is in the investing field. And, you know, I think we need to hear these stories. Now, I am often criticized because I try to discuss this sort of thing. I discuss what's happened on discussion boards, the campaign of terror against the retire early boards and the indexing boards led by the passive investing dogmatist. And a lot of people don't like to hear it. They feel it's sort of ugly. You know, my father used to tell me, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. And that's good advice. So, you know, I understand why people have discomfort, and it may be that Shiller has discomfort in getting into that sort of thing. Yet, the reason I do it is I believe it's an important part of the story because, you see, the big puzzle is not how does stock investing work. That's not that hard to figure out. If you go looking for evidence, you can find the reality. So I did it. I used to believe in passive investing, and I did a little research putting together my retire early plan, and I found the realities, so others obviously could do it. But the hard thing, it's not finding it. The hard thing is understanding why doesn't everybody tell you this? You know, the safe withdrawal rate studies, we discovered that they're analytically invalid 6-7 years ago. Why is it not common knowledge today? Why isn't it being shouted from the rooftops to warn all the people? Well, there was a thread at bogleheads.org again just a few weeks ago where they talked about safe withdrawal rates. And, you know, there were a number of people who said, quite openly, this, you know, Larry Swedro said, you know, he's an author of many books in the investing field. He said, the old school studies are junk in, junk out. You know, it's garbage, garbage in, garbage out. And of course, he's right. They don't look at the factors that affect the safe withdrawal rate. So obviously, they get the number wrong. I mean, it's no surprise. But then there were people who came onto that thread and they said, instead of acknowledging that the studies are analytically invalid, the logical step to take then is to try to help all the people who have been misled all these years. Before it was the Bogleheads board, it was the Vanguard Diehards board, and they were advocating these studies. Mel Lindauer and Taylor Larimore have a book, The Bogleheads Guide to Investing, where they link or they cite the old school safe withdrawal rate studies positively. They're telling people to use these studies to plan their retirements. And of course, they're all over the internet. You enter retirement planning tools and you're going to get links to these old school studies. Well, why wouldn't the Bogleheads, now that they've discovered that these studies are analytically invalid, why not make the case? Why not go out and warn people of the dangers? But then the thread took this turn where several people jumped in and they said, oh, you know, why don't we just stop talking about safe withdrawal rates? You know, people should just, it was only a rule of thumb. It doesn't matter if it's accurate or not. Let's talk about other things. You know, they don't want to talk about it. And that's a problem. And that's where you get into the situation where people think it's rude to correct errors. And if you're going to turn investing into a science, you're going to have to agree to correct errors. That just comes with the game. And, you know, again, I'm more talking about what we need to do with Schiller's work in the future than what he did in his book. But over time, I think it'd be wonderful if we heard Schiller's stories of all the people who have attacked him. Not for the purpose of rubbing their nose in the dirt or making them feel bad or any such thing. The purpose would be to learn. You know, it'd be great if the people who did it came forward and said, look, I once criticized this guy, and now I see how wrong I was and how emotional I was. And look at this letter I wrote, you know, look at this article I wrote, faulting Schiller, calling him junk science when he was right all along and I was wrong. You know, some stories like that, those pack a punch. People read that and it's got blood and guts in it. It's got real life in it. And that's how you persuade people. That's how you turn the switch from the passive investing switch to the rational investing switch. So in that sense, he pulls his punches. Now, again, I think it was appropriate for him not to give those stories in the book he wrote back in 2000. But I would like to hear those stories, and I bet there are a lot of them. I bet there are a lot of good stories of that nature that Schiller knows about. He does not offer investing advice in his book. That's one way in which I think Schiller pulled his punches. And it may have been, I've always felt it was odd. He writes this wonderful book explaining how investing works, and nowhere does he really discuss what the implications are for what people should do. That's what I've tried to do in my work. I've tried to take Schiller's work, Schiller's thinking, and translate it into what does this mean for what the investor should do with his allocation at various price levels. And I always wondered why Schiller didn't do it. And perhaps it was another case where he felt the time was not right. That if he started giving investing advice, people would distort what he was saying, you know, as they've so often distorted what I've said. You know, I say, people need to look at valuations and they need to look at long-term value propositions and say, Rob believes in short-term timing. You know, nothing could be further from the truth. Or they say, Rob is anti-stock. You know, nothing could be further from the truth. So perhaps Schiller believed that they would do those same things with him. And so he laid out how stock investing works without drawing the implications to investing strategy. But again, that's a way in which it could be argued he pulled his punches, and it's a way in which I think followers of Schiller should not pull their punches. Obviously, this whole podcast is largely aimed at Rob Bennett. You know, it's me thinking through how, you know, where should I go with my writing? You know, where should I go with the work I do in this field? You know, what avenues should I go down? Because I'm sort of taking Schiller and taking it to another stage. I never could have gotten there, you know, without the master having pioneered the road. But now that he's pioneered the road, I don't think the right thing to do is just, you know, to reiterate what he said 8-9 years ago. The right thing to do is to take it to new places, new and more exciting places. Schiller has not called out the leading figures in the field who have made serious analytical errors. You know, people like Bogle, Clements, Bernstein, Burns, all the people we talk about at PassionSaving.com. Now, again, I know that I have affection and respect for these people. I am certain that Schiller does as well. And so you have to do it in the right way. You have to do it in the right spirit. You know, it would be wrong, and I know that he obviously would never do this. It would be wrong to criticize these people in an ungentlemanly way. But it's not wrong to correct their errors. And I don't think it's even kind not to correct their errors. This is a point I got into when I was on the Vanguard Diehards board, and I had written an article at my website. I didn't post it at the board. It was someone else who posted it. But I had written an article called Bogle's Big Mistake, and someone over there posted it. And the purpose was to inflame. You know, there are obviously lots of Bogle supporters there, and I'm a Bogle supporter. And the idea was to inflame them, you know, and to get me banned from the board. That was the intent. But I didn't apologize for the article. The article is a good piece of work, I believe. And I really disagree with the idea that there was an idea put forward by a lot of good people I respect, the one that I think of, there was a woman whose screen name was Kathleen Ryan, and I don't know if that's just a screen name or if that's a true, I think it might be a true name, because I think my recollection is she published some sort of game, some investing game, you know, based on Bogle's ideas. And she was a very nice, sincere, intelligent person. And I had some interactions with her because I think my sense is that she didn't like the smear campaign. And she tried to interact with me in a very human way. And we had a thread where we talked about poetry, and we had a thread where we talked about Catholic schools. And she was just she was a pleasure. And I think she was trying to calm down, calm down the nastiness. And there was no nastiness on my part, I hope. I don't think so. But there was nastiness on the other end, and she was sort of trying to pull me into the, she was sort of a well-respected figure, and I think the idea was sort of to calm everybody down by her indicating she approved of my posting. But when I, when the post came up about Bogle's errors, Kathleen was saying, "Rob, he's a nice man. He's a nice man. Why do you do this?" And that doesn't cut it for me, not even a little bit. He is a nice man, but the fact that you're a nice man doesn't mean people shouldn't point out your errors if you're giving investing advice that is flawed, because people suffer, and of course Bogle himself suffered. The very fact that he's a nice man is the reason why we have to tell him when he's wrong, because a nice man doesn't want to hurt people, so he doesn't want people to have their retirements fail. He doesn't want people to not be able to retire on time, or not be able to send their kids to college, or not be able to buy a bigger home, or whatever it is. Bogle wants to give good advice. And to do so, he needs to have a community of people who will tell him the truth. And that includes telling him when he gets something wrong. So I wish we could change that aspect of the investing project. I very, very, very much wish we could change that aspect of the investing project. And that's something that I feel Shiller overlooked. Perhaps, whether he's aware of it or not, he may be aware of it, and he chose not to address it in prudence. Or it may be he's not aware of it. It may be that, what happens a pioneer, I used that word before, a path maker, Schiller's cutting the path through the forest, through the jungle, and the rest of us are following. But when you're cutting the path, you can't always see as clearly as the people who follow after you. Each generation of people following these ideas is going to see farther than the one before. And when you have ideas as seminal as Schiller's ideas, there are going to be generations who are going to follow and take these ideas to new places. I would call myself the post-Schiller generation of writers on stock investing. So I am saying that part of the agenda moving forward is being more personal, not nasty. People will characterize what I do as nasty in an attempt to undermine it, in an attempt to, turn it into something ugly and thereby defeat it. But I never intend to be nasty, and I don't think I ever have been. But being frank, we need much more frankness in criticisms of investing experts who get it wrong, investing experts who are wedded to old discredited theories. And, that was the whole idea. I was thinking that idea through when I came up with the name for the section of my website that I call Heroes and Villains. That's what I was thinking about that back then. That was a couple years ago. And I think I was thinking about the Bogle article. That was one of the things on my mind. It was a hard article to write because I knew that there were going to be people who would be upset about it. And of course, I think of myself as a big Bogle fan. I think of Bogle as a godfather of the rational investing model. So the last thing I wanted to do was alienate Bogle supporters. I need those people. Those are my people. But I think in kindness and in charity, we need to tell people when they get things wrong. That, to me, is the beauty of community, that you get something wrong and somebody will step in and help you out. And so I think, you could argue that Schiller pulled his punches by not doing much of that in his book, but, he may do it in his next book, or someone following in his path may do it, or he may have refrained from doing it in prudence. Here's a big way in which I think Schiller pulled his punches, and this is one in which I think maybe Schiller wasn't aware fully of the implications. Or perhaps he, again, perhaps it was a prudence question. Perhaps he felt it was he had a more effective way of making his case. But I was thinking the other day, I don't know, I forget the context, but I was thinking about the fact that I refer to the investing ideas presented at my site as rational investing. You know, I have I call it an entire model, you know, a model that replaces the passive investing model. And some will look at that and they'll say, you know, how, I don't know, I guess you could say it's presumptuous or, you know, excessively bold. How dare you, you know, some guy who posts on the internet, how dare you claim to have built an entire new model, not just a new strategy, but a new model of understanding how stock investing works. Well, of course, what I say is that I did not so much develop this model. I articulated it, and I felt there was a need for a name for the ideas in order to be able to refer to it. But rational investing has been around since the beginning of time. And of course, people like Schiller and Bogle and Buffett are the godfathers. That, you know, it's their ideas that drive it. I just, you know, made corrections in the errors that I discovered and mixed those ideas in a way that they had never been mixed before. That's all. And then thought it through a bit. And of course, I had, you know, I had the benefit of contributions of hundreds of fine community members helping me out at every stage of the way, especially John Walter Russell, as always. But it struck me that Schiller doesn't do that. You know, Schiller, he talks about investing, and you know, he clearly is presenting. You know, here in the title of the book, the subtitle, they call it, they say, Irrational Exuberance, the national bestseller that revolutionized the way we think about the stock market. Well, a revolution. They're saying that Schiller started a revolution, so they're saying that he started a new model, but he doesn't. He doesn't give it a name. He doesn't say, this is rational investing. And in a way, that's pulling a punch, because what that has led to, I feel that many people have not, well, not many people, almost everyone, has failed to give Schiller the credit he merits. What people did was, they read his book, they praised it to the skies. You know, it was a best-selling book. But they go right back to pretending that passive investing works. You know, they read the book on Tuesday, they say it revolutionizes investing, and then on Wednesday, somebody asks Jonathan Clements, you know, at the Wall Street Journal, he's not there anymore, but, you know, he was there for a long time. They ask him, John, you know, Jonathan, I'm worried about, you know, the high valuations in the stock market, should I lower my allocation? And Jonathan says, oh no, the efficient market theory says, you know, there's no way to time the market. You should stay at your same allocation. You know, and on Tuesday, he read Robert Schiller's book. I'm not trying to pick on Jonathan. The point is, how can you do that? Both things cannot be true. The efficient market theory cannot be true and false at the same time. If it's true, the passive investors are right. We can't time the market. We should not change our allocations when prices change dramatically. If the efficient market theory is true, the safe withdrawal rate is a stable number. But if it's false, as Schiller shows it to be in his research, if it's false, we can time the market. At least we can engage in long-term timing. Maybe not short-term timing, but certainly we can engage in long-term timing effectively. And it's not only can we do it, we must do it. Or we'll lose decades worth of life savings in these horrible price crashes. Misunderstanding how the market works causes price crashes. And if the efficient market theory is false, as Schiller's evidence shows, then the investing advice of the last 20, 30 years is wrong, needs to be changed. So I think the way to go is to describe this new model as a new model and to give it a name. And I don't care if people call it rational investing or not. That's just a name I came up with so that I have terminology. But we do need to start talking as if We're not talking about that old Schiller is not just giving some new tips to add to the storehouse of tips. You know, here's something else to keep in mind. He is rejecting the old model, and he's proposing a new model. And it says that on the cover of the book. He revolutionized the way we think about the stock market. But did he really? You see, that's the question. He revolutionized it. He made the case that requires it to be revolutionized. But then the investing, quote, experts failed to implement the implications of what Shiller has shown to be so. So we're living in a twilight zone. We're living in a world in which we know the efficient market theory doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Not one of the 200 academics would raise his hand when asked, did he believe in this stuff? But yet the middle-class investor, you know, writes into a columnist and says, what should I do? And the columnist says, oh, you know, buy and hold, stay the course. Stocks for the long run. It's that, you know, that doesn't work. And so Shiller or Shiller's followers need to be more bold in how they present what they have brought to the table. They've brought something very new. They've brought a new model. I call it rational investing. We will have new Shillers. That's sort of the point of all this. We all, one of the critical insights that Shiller has brought to our attention is what he said in that article in The Atlantic, you know, that I read just the other day. I'm not sure when it was published. I think recently. We only learn, I've had this experience, you know, I've talked about this before, but each stage, you know, I've been on a journey for 6.5 years learning how stock investing works. I never expected to learn the things I've learned. And the way it's worked is that at various stages, I've had to work up courage to say something in public that I knew was going to cause me to be attacked and smeared and all this sort of thing. And each time I did it, I felt a sense of liberation. I didn't like the attacks did come and the smears did come. But the learning just took off like a rocket. I opened a door each time. You know, a big one I mentioned on just a recent podcast was the day that I said the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are analytically invalid. That took a lot for me to say that. I was scared. And of course I was right. And I've been proven right over and over and over again. But there are still people today. There are still people today who call themselves investing experts and who are quite knowledgeable in the field, in fairness, who cannot get themselves to say the word the old school studies are analytically invalid. They still live in fear. And what Shiller says is, we all turn to other humans to gain a sense of what is right and what is wrong. And he's right. And we need to have other humans saying that the old school studies are analytically invalid and that the efficient market theory doesn't stand up to scrutiny and that passive investing doesn't work in the real world. Long-term timing works. Long-term timing is required to be an effective long-term investor. We need more people saying these things. And if the leaders, you know, there's always going to be a spectrum of opinion. There's always going to be, you know, the people who are on the far side of the passive investing spectrum, and then the people who are on the far side of the rational investing spectrum, and then most people are always going to be in the middle somewhere. That's always the way it's going to play out. But the unhealthy situation we are in today, you know, December of 2008, is the passive investors are dogmatic. They don't pull any punches at all. You know, they go way over the line of what should be acceptable in civil, you know, human discourse. But the ones who understand rational investing very, very well, and there are many people who understand it well, go to the bogleheads.org site. There are hundreds there who understand this stuff. You know, I can point you to threads where they talk about it, and they've been talking about it for years. They're all ahead of Bogle. You know, again, no dig intended, but they're all miles ahead of Bogle. They learned from Bogle, I imagine, just as I did, but they've surpassed him because they're not hung up about this passive investing junk. And those people pull their punches. If Schiller, I don't think Schiller really did. The ultimate answer to my question is I don't think he really did pull his punches. I think he acted in prudence properly. So, but people who are reluctant today to even go as far as Schiller did are pulling their punches, and they're hurting us, because when the debate is held, the one side is so extreme in its presentation and so intimidating, in their claims to be rooted in science and all this sort of thing, and the other side is so tentative. They'll lay out an idea, and if they get any hostility at all, they just pull back and say, "Oh, what do I know?" We need to be stronger, because as the side who understands how investing works gets stronger, the people in the middle become better informed. They then have more trust in the message, and it snowballs. You get a few, and then you get a few more, and then you get a few more, and it multiplies and multiplies and multiplies. And then one of these days, passive investing is no more. That's the goal in my mind. Now, I say it that way, you see, for a purpose, because I don't pull my punches. I used to. I saw how much harm it did to people when we all pull our punches. And I decided that what I should do is not pull my punches. What I should do is state what I believe. I shouldn't exaggerate. I shouldn't state beyond what I believe. But I should state precisely what I believe. I shouldn't pull my punches at all. I should try to test the limits of what can be said, because that's the only way we're going to open up space for future Robert Shillers. And there are going to be future Robert Shillers. His ideas are too important to stop with him. Generations of investing analysts are going to learn from his book and from his ideas and from how they work in the real world. And in order to open up space for all that creative knowledge making to happen, we all need to work up the courage to state things a little more clearly, a little more directly, a little more boldly. We all need to work not to pull our punches. We all need to be little Robert Shillers, brave, courageous thinkers, testing the limits of what can be said in InvestoWorld about how stock investing really works in the long term. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.